The briefing takes place in the motor repair shop of the heavy section, that branch of the LRDG whose role is to supply petrol, ammunition and rations to the fighting patrols. The shop is the only space that has windproof walls to keep dust out of the newly machined engines, and is big enough and cool enough for comfort. It is called the barn. Three officers preside: Major Eason-Smith, commanding the operation as a whole, Captain Bill Kennedy Shaw, LRDG intelligence officer, and Major Main, commanding the SAS. Present are all LRDG patrol officers and their senior NCOs. The feel of the briefing is extremely casual. There are no chairs, so the fellows perch on test stands or benches or simply camp on the floor with their knees up and their arms round their bare legs. The uniform is shorts and shirts, with chaplets, the box-toed sandals that the men favour over boots because they're cooler in the heat and because scorpions and spiders can't hide inside them. A sergeant named Collier closes the big sliding shop doors. At the front, Kennedy Shaw pins a blow-up photo to a presentation stand. The photo is of Rommel. I glance round to see whether any of the officers appear surprised. If they are, they don't show it. Sergeant Collier comes back and takes the seat beside me on a wooden crate of 303 ball ammunition. "The Desert Fox," says Kennedy Shaw, indicating the photo. "For nearly 2 years, every man in this room has burned to get a crack at him." "Well," he says, "soon you shall." Briefly, Kennedy Shaw goes over Rommel's early career, his spectacular success as an infantry officer in the Great War, his winning of the Pour le Mérite, the triumph of his book, Infantry in the Attack. Kennedy Shaw is trying to give us a sense of the man. "Rommel's physical courage is beyond question. The hallmark of his fighting style is audacity and aggressiveness." In the invasion of France in 1940, Rommel commands the crack 7th Panzer Division. This formation spearheads the blitzkrieg breakthrough of the Ardennes, the blow that breaks France's back. Rommel's reward is command of DAK, the Deutsches Afrika Korps, and all German troops and armour in Tunisia and Libya. Now elevated to Lieutenant General, Rommel lands at Tripoli in February 1941. In his first campaign, before half his men and tanks have arrived from Europe, he chases Western Desert Force out of Cyrenaica, driving our armoured divisions back nearly 1,000 miles to the Egyptian frontier. The British press, in effect, knight him by bestowing the title Desert Fox. Churchill himself declares, "We have a very daring and skilful opponent against us, and, may I say, across the havoc of war, a great general." "No one has to tell this to the British soldier," says Kennedy Shaw. So powerful is Rommel's hold over our Tommy's imagination that General Auchinleck, Commander-in-Chief of 8th Army, felt it necessary last spring to issue the following directive. "There exists a real danger that our friend Rommel is becoming a kind of magician or bogeyman to our troops, who are talking far too much about him. He is by no means a superman, and is highly undesirable that our men should credit him with supernatural powers. We must refer to the Germans, or the Axis powers, and not always keep harping on Rommel. Please impress upon all commanders that, from a psychological point of view, this is a matter of the highest importance." "What makes the Rommel myth even thornier to contend with," Kennedy Shaw continues, "is the fact that he fits neither the stereotype of the rapacious Hun nor that of the brutish doctrinaire Nazi. He is not a member of the party and never has been. His code of soldierly honour was shaped by the era of Prussian arms before the rise of National Socialism. He is, we are told, a warrior from a bygone era, an old-fashioned knight for whom the virtues of chivalry and respect for the foe are indivisible from the passion for victory." "In other words," says Kennedy Shaw, "you can't even hate the bastard." Rommel's men worship him, Kennedy Shaw declares. He is unique, essential, indispensable. No German general can replace him. This is the strength of the Rommel phenomenon and its weakness. Eliminate this one man, says Kennedy Shaw, and you drive a stake through the Axis heart in North Africa. He indicates the photo of the Desert Fox. That, my friends, is where you come in. Kennedy Shaw turns the briefing over to Major Easonsmith. Jake thanks him and comes forward with a sly look towards his audience. Do I have your attention, gentlemen? For the first time, laughter breaks up the concentration. I know what you're thinking, says Jake. The job can't be done, and we're just the fellows to do it. More laughter. A coffee flask is passed round. Cigarettes are lit. Next to me, Sergeant Collier tamps his Sherlock Holmes pipe and refires it. Jake begins, describing Rommel's style of command. Rommel leads from the front. He's got guts. Give him that. He doesn't manage the battle by a telephone. As Jake speaks, he distributes a number of Africa Corps propaganda photos depicting Rommel in various frontline environments, in staff cars, on Mark IV Panzers, and so forth. Rommel's aggressive instincts, Jake says, have made him thrust himself again and again into the thick of the fight. In other words, gentlemen, the single most important enemy personage upon whom the outcome of the entire North African war depends will not be sitting safely hundreds of miles behind the lines where we have no hope of getting at him, but will, in all probability, be placing himself deliberately out in front in broad daylight, protected by nothing stouter than an open command car. All we have to do is find him. The men are given photos of the vehicles that comprise Rommel's mobile headquarters, his Gefechtstaffel, whose identifying characteristics we are to study and commit to memory. A field marshal's command post, Jake reminds the men, will stand out amidst acres of other vehicles by virtue of its concentration of wireless aerials, the steady traffic of couriers funneling to it, and the beefed-up security roundabout. These factors, too, will enlarge our chances of success. This produces the briefing's second laugh. A sergeant pipes up, "What are we supposed to do, sir? Go swanning about the desert hoping to run into the bastard?" "Sigint has learned," Jake responds, meaning Signals Intelligence, our radio intercept fellows, "that each night when circumstances prevent Rommel from returning to his proper HQ in the rear, his wireless operator sends a single coded signal at a specific hour, different each night, informing his headquarters staff of their commander-in-chief's whereabouts." "Our spies," Jake says, "have acquired this schedule." He indicates the words "Desert Fox" on the chalkboard. What this means is that the DF can be DF'd, meaning located by radio directional finding. By no means does this warrant that Rommel will stay put. Where he sets down at 1900 may not be where he remains at 1930. That's where you fellows come in. Major Mayne, will you take over? Paddy Mayne steps forward. To those of his era, no introduction would be necessary, but for later readers, let me say only that Mayne had been a rugby star before the war on a par with the great champions of any age. He is a Cambridge man and a solicitor. By war's end, he will become Britain's most highly decorated soldier, and with the exception only of his commanding officer in the SAS, David Stirling, the most celebrated British commando of the North African War. "What does this mean, sir?" A voice addresses the Major. "That we pinhole Rommel and go in with all guns blazing?" Mayne smiles. "I wish it did, lads. But it looks as if the RAF will be getting all the glory." The first groan ascends. "Our ground party's assignment," Mayne explains, is to penetrate the enemy's defences, getting close enough to the target either to fix its bearings or, if possible, to mark Rommel's location with red smoke. Fighter planes of the Royal Air Force will take care of the kill. Our role is to clean up anything left over and then get the hell out. At this, the briefing breaks into muttered indignation. For my part, though by war's end I will have participated in a number of such assemblies, during which outlandish assignments are imparted with absolutely straight faces, and during which I invariably feel my blood run cold, I cannot fail to be astonished at the keen and cheerful fervour with which this near-suicidal mission is embraced. "Rotten luck," says Maine. "The Air Force boys have beaten us this time. Still, our turn should be damn brisk sport. Don't give up hope, lads. I've seen these aviation types come up empty more than once. If they kick it, we'll get our shot." The briefing breaks up in high spirits. The men, who all know each other from their units and from prior operations, move off into their various groups to work out the details of their individual assignments. I find myself alone, picturing in my mind the vast expanse of the Western Desert and the tens of thousands of soldiers, tanks and guns of the Africa Corps. Is it just me, or is this operation as preposterous as it sounds? I turn to the Kiwi sergeant, Collier, who has been perched on an ammunition crate beside me throughout the briefing. He looks the athletic sort, who on Civvy Street had probably been a rugby player or mountaineer, as so many NZers are. "What do you make of this show, Sergeant?" The New Zealander turns to me with a grin. "Sounds like a dodgy do to me, sir.